In the studio with me, our political editor, Mark Devenport, our business and economics editor, John Campbell.
Good morning.
Morning, Mark.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, John. Good morning.
Hello. Yes,
good morning.
I said
did you say good morning?
Yes,
thank
yes,
you. Thank you.
You've
so in terms, John, of the DUP strategy with Brexit, mm-hmm. if they were here today, what questions would you be asking them?
I think I would most like to ask them about the early days of Brexit policy. So even before the referendum, did they fail to appreciate potentially how this could unfold for the union? Should they have given greater thought to how they would seek to shape Brexit? Because you can argue, you know, that all the stuff which has happened recently they have opposed, but perhaps you would say the mistakes were made earlier on. And in particular, one area I think I would like to ask them about is when they had that leverage over Theresa May after the election, when Theresa May was clearly going to be relying on them to deliver Brexit, should they at that stage have said, yes, Theresa May, we will support you, but only if you choose to deliver a very soft Brexit, one which will still honour the Brexit vote, but will minimise the risk to Northern Ireland's position in the United Kingdom. Now, it seems at that stage that, in fact, the DUP Westminster team really hitched their wagon to the harder Brexit elements like the ERG and the Jacob Rees-Mogg of this world. So was that a mistake? In retrospect, should they have used their influence a couple of years ago to actually say, yes, we'll support you on Brexit, Theresa May, but only if you support a softer Brexit, one which will minimise the risk to the union? Because, you know, as we go further down the line, you can say that the DUP did oppose both Theresa May's backstop and also Boris Johnson's front stop, effectively. But the question for me is, did you make your mistake here much earlier on in this process?
And a mistake, if there was a mistake made in their negotiating tactic, at what cost, Mark, to the union?
Well, potentially at major cost, because if Boris Johnson actually gets a majority, he is saying that he will force through what he terms his oven-ready deal. Now, he is stipulating over the weekend, oh, there won't be any checks on trade across the Irish Sea, but all the experts who've analysed that say that doesn't actually match up to the fine print of the agreement.
And in fact, Arlene Foster has said the same this morning.
Arlene Foster on Radio 4 says that the HMRC has told the DUP that there will be checks on those goods across the Irish Sea. I think she was implying certainly coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. I'm not sure whether she talked about the exit declarations that it has been said by the Brexit Secretary will be made the other way. But either way, they've got a problem. They can say, look, we stopped it. This is what, say, Emma Little-Pengelly said in a debate over the weekend. We stopped it when it came to it. But they won't necessarily have that leverage in the next parliament unless we get a hung parliament to keep on stopping it. And they may have allowed the horse to bolt already.
Yeah, we played earlier the DUP bringing Boris Johnson over to Northern Ireland when he was seeking to be the new leader of the Conservative Party, and the cheers and the rapturous applause that the DUP gave him. They clearly trusted him. I note that Arlene Foster is now saying that she will never take Boris Johnson at his word again. Once bitten, twice shy were her exact words. And she has talked about, she's accused Boris Johnson of a betrayal over Brexit, saying he broke his word that a withdrawal agreement would not include a border in the Irish Sea. But this is the man they trusted.
Yeah, and you know, I suppose you look at Boris Johnson's career and you might ask, you know, was it necessarily wise to have trusted him in that way? But Mark is correct in that, you know, the DUP may still have leverage should we get to a hung parliament, which we can't rule out entirely at this stage. And, you know, we look in the DUP manifesto and there's a couple of things they say they would aim to do if they have influence again. One, they say there must be unfettered access for Northern Ireland to and from the GB market, which certainly the current deal would not permit. And the customs and consent arrangement must be revisited because they say the whole approval mechanism for the Assembly takes no account of power sharing. So that is where they would try and alter this deal. But the difficulty, I think, for them is that both with Theresa May and with Boris Johnson, we know the general shape of a deal which a UK government will be prepared to agree with the EU and one which the EU will wear. And really, that deal is one in which Northern Ireland is going to be treated differently.
The difficulty is that the changes that they want to ensure are not necessarily in the UK government's gift to give, because there's been a negotiation already with the EU. The Irish government clearly understood the whole potential of giving unionists a veto at the Northern Ireland Assembly should it ever come back. They didn't want to go down that line, and so that's why they changed that consent mechanism to a majority vote in the full knowledge that it will probably approve increasing sort of harmonisation with the EU and also not stop it. So, you know, it's not going to be very easy for the DUP. Could be more or less impossible if we're in a Conservative majority situation.
And can I just get... Sorry, John, go ahead.
I think the irony also for the DUP is that Jeremy Corbyn, who they do not like at all and say they will not support if it comes to it, he would offer a much more unionist-friendly Brexit, because his plan is that the whole of the UK would remain in a customs union with the EU. So you eliminate many of those across the Irish Sea customs problem, perhaps entirely. And he also says that the Labour Party would seek a very close relationship with the single market. So that would be a very soft Brexit, and that is the one which would start to address many of those Irish Sea issues. Now,
well, the DUP haven't ruled out working with Labour. They just have ruled out working with Corbyn.
Yeah.
And I repeat the question to the DUP, why have they not ruled out working with Boris Johnson if, in essence, he's threatening the union in their view?
Yeah, because the Brexit kind of offers from Labour and the Conservatives are starkly different. And it's very clear the one which would mean less friction, perhaps no friction on the Irish Sea, is Labour's. Now, I think Labour have a difficulty in terms of describing their single market offer that they would like, because they don't really want to get involved in the free movement issue. And, you know, realistically, if you want a very soft Brexit, you're still going to probably have to accept free movement.
And John...
They have, I was just going to say, on Corbyn, they have kind of a historical and emotional problem working with Jeremy Corbyn because of his closeness to figures like Gerry Adams down through the years of the Troubles. But here's the difficulty that I see with their position, which is that if Jeremy Corbyn, you know, at the moment, 10 points behind, most people are thinking he won't be in government. But if he delivers an election result which allows him to form a government with Labour as the major party within that, how many people within the Labour Party will be pressing for him to stand down? So is it realistic to say, oh, we'll only work with another leader in that scenario?
And John, just to be for me to be crystal clear, despite what the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is saying, I want unionists to know this in Northern Ireland. If Boris Johnson's deal goes through, will there be a so-called border down the Irish Sea, and will goods be checked, no matter what Boris Johnson's saying?
GB to NI, there will certainly have to be checks. That is in the deal. Now, in terms of what happens NI to GB, most of that is in the gift of the British government. And I think business is confident that the government can minimise any new administrative burden NI to GB. But, you know, make no mistake about it, if Northern Ireland is effectively in the single market and the rest of the UK is not, and if Northern Ireland is enforcing the EU's customs code at its ports, that is going to mean new processes, new administration, new checks on goods coming in here from GB. Now, we have a year, supposedly, in which the details of that will be worked through between the UK and the EU to try and minimise that. But under Boris Johnson's deal, we will not end up with the status quo. Trade across the Irish Sea will be different, and it potentially has implications for the economy here.
Let me maybe you can stay here with me for another few minutes. Thomas in Antrim has called us. There are loads of you calling us today. 03030 80 55 55. Morning, Thomas.
This is Thomas from Saudi Arabia. Stephen, I've spoken to you a couple of times, and I'm so proud of you today, because I would say you're speaking for at least a million people, probably more, in the questions that you're put forward. And they had their choice to come in and answer those questions, and they didn't do it. So if they start and come and criticise you, they don't have a leg to stand on. But then neither have I. Part of the reason why I come home is...
Well, look, Sammy Wilson has said the DUP come up with a policy to try to harm me as much as possible. The bottom line is, my job's to try to get answers for you all, and I'll continue doing that job. And I would encourage the DUP to come back into the Nolan studio and let's move on. But it's not about a relationship between me and the DUP. I don't need a relationship with any politician. It's about you and all of you listening to this programme being able to get answers to your questions before you decide where to put a vote. And to be fair to the DUP, they do speak to other broadcasters here at the BBC elsewhere.
Stephen, you're the biggest show in the country. You've got huge fan base. Everybody listens to you. And you're doing a professional job as a journalist. It's nothing personal, pal. They should do a professional job as a political party and come on and answer those questions. And like, I'm home here now. I'm looking for a job. York Street Interchange, £20 million. When's it going to start? And I'm on the way to the doctor now to try and get an appointment, and I'm having to walk into the appointment to get it because it's 4 weeks waiting. A varicose veins, I can hardly walk. Am I going to wait 2 years for an operation? If they are, I'm back on the plane to Saudi Arabia. I'm sorry, I come home. And I hate to say that because I love this place.
Well, health is a big issue. And Thomas, thank you for your call today. Mark Devenport, in terms of the current dispute that there is in Northern Ireland between with the health workers, they're saying they want parity. The DUP broke that parity. It was the DUP minister who decided that nurses in Northern Ireland and doctors and health workers would not be paid the same as those across the water, right?
Yes. In 2014, Jim Wells decided not to accept the recommendation of the NHS pay review, which happened across the UK. They were obviously under a lot of pressure in terms of austerity at that time. They were trying to make ends meet and health had overspent. He explained both in a newspaper interview with the Sunday Life over the weekend and earlier on Good Morning Ulster that it was a fair cop to say that he did it, but that was because he couldn't balance the books. There's a dispute, I think, between the parties as to whether it was purely a DUP decision or to what extent the executive waved it through. The DUP has claimed on a couple of occasions this had executive backing because, of course, executive ministers would have signed off on the overall budget. Whereas, I think, in an election debate over the weekend, Naomi Long said, oh, you're only trying to spread responsibility because you want to spread the blame. And I see Michelle O'Neill just within the last few minutes, and this is probably in reference to the Jim Wells interview earlier. She says some facts for the BBC. Jim Wells broke parity by not giving a 1% pay increase. Simon Hamilton made the situation worse by not giving a 1% increase. In stark contrast, I gave a 1% pay increase. However, it should also be said that she wrote to the same pay review body saying we have to keep our wages here in line with the government's austerity measures. So there was, I think, a bit of a collective responsibility, but it was definitely a DUP ministers who did it, who broke parity. And I should just say, since it's a manifesto interview, they've got a section here in their manifesto, Fairness in Public Sector Pay, and it says, with the end of austerity, there needs to be a prioritisation of the public sector pay rises, especially in our NHS, police and armed forces. This means pay rises should not only take account of inflation, but of the need to uplift rates to restore the full value of public sector pay. So there's basically saying we should try and make good on this in the future.
And where are they getting the money from to do that, John?
I think, again, slightly ironically, a Jeremy Corbyn-led government would make those promises about above-inflation pay rises for the public sector much easier to deliver on, because there is quite a stark difference between the tax and spending policies of Labour and the Conservatives. So Labour would spend over the lifetime of the Parliament about just over 10% more than the current plan suggest. Labour would spend, day-to-day spending would be 33% more, so a huge increase in day-to-day spending. On infrastructure spending, it's even bigger. Effectively, Labour say they would double the amount the UK spends on infrastructure over the lifetime of the Parliament. So if you're going to say which party is going to give us a lot more money in the block grant to tackle all the problems we say we will tackle in this manifesto, well, hands down, you say it's Labour.
Mark mentioned there about Michelle O'Neill and what she's been saying on Twitter today. Conor Murphy is confirmed to be in the Nolan studio tomorrow morning representing Sinn Féin. And Sinn Féin have said, yes, that they're coming into the programme like every other political party, except the DUP, to try to sell you their vision as to why you should vote for them. Jim's in West Belfast. Morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen. I was telling your researcher, you see this here, this waiting list, big topical issue in this country and across the UK at the minute, 300,000 people. You see the problem with our MLAs at the minute, and this is across the board, DUP, Sinn Féin, SDLP, they are all emotionally devoid of the realities of living a normal working class life. I'll tell you why. If a woman finds a lump in her breast, or a man finds a lump in her prostate, or whatever, or back pains, or whatever, they have to go to the doctors, and they're told to wait. These MLAs, people like myself would have to wait maybe 18 months, 2 years. These MLAs can go private and be seen within 7 to 10 days. They haven't got the worry that we have. They're emotionally devoid of the realities of everyday life. And I'll tell you,
Clearly, many would argue that that's not true, Jim.
First of all, you don't know how many of them
have private medical care.
Why do you interrupt when people are talking? My point being is, they're on good 50 to 60 grand a year.
They're on 30 odd grand a year, right, after their pay cut.
It's been cut now.
Right, it's been cut, but the reality is they have been on a substantial enough wage that over the course of the past 2.5-3 years since the executive has closed, they could afford private health care. This is my point. So there's no MLAs who will have to wait 18 months, 2 years, because when you budget your money, if I was on 30 grand or 40 grand a year, I would certainly have private health insurance.
The programme today is about the DUP. And the DUP manifesto, Jim. So I guess my question to you is, do you think the DUP is doing the right thing by refusing to allow Sinn Féin to have an Irish Language Act? Or are things like the health service and them getting back into government to sort out the health service with the other political parties, is that more important?
Well, my answer to that there is, Northern Ireland is an integral part of the United Kingdom, like Wales is, like Scotland, right, and like England. If England have an act, Scotland have an act, Northern Ireland, as part of the United Kingdom, should be entitled. See, the DUP can't cherry pick, and this is what they do. The cherry pick of what's meant good for union and what is not good for the union. Now, the Irish language doesn't suit the DUP's narrative, but the DUP have to accept too that Northern Ireland, they'd be the first to tell you, Mr. Nolan, that Northern Ireland is an integral part of the United Kingdom. So if an Irish language is part of restored evolution, that has to be respected in the same way that the DUP may have things they want met. That has to be respected. But my point about the DUP not coming on your show, the DUP don't have, like, they let themselves down. The DUP will have their hardline voters who will go out on Thursday and who will vote DUP. But you have to understand too, there's a young generation coming up now of people who look at the DUP and who look at Sinn Féin and who go elsewhere to cast their vote. The dynamics of this country are completely changing, and so I don't think you really care if a DUP talk to you or not. They're actually doing you a favour. They're giving you self promotion. Sinn Féin will come on tomorrow, and Conor Murphy will say what he has to say. But the reality is, I'm an ISIS from West Belfast. I look at Arlene Foster and the DUP, and I just think, my God, what are these people? How arrogant is their attitude towards the people of Northern Ireland?
Jim, thank you for your call. Mark Davenport, remind us when there was an agreement that the DUP said wasn't an agreement. Was it a draft agreement, etc., etc., where an Irish language type of act, was it discussed? Was it agreed? Can you remind us what the reality was?
This was back in February 2017, yes. I think. And this was the draft deal, which a copy of which was obtained by the journalists Eamon Malley and Brian Rowan. And that talked about a kind of suite of legislation. And basically, I think the DUP negotiators on that were Simon Hamilton and Edwin Poots. And I think they were trying to sort of pull off a bit of a conjuring act whereby by having an Ulster Scots Act, an Irish Language Act, kind of linked, supposedly, all linked together, supposedly falling if they weren't all passed. They were going to kind of say, look, this is an umbrella approach to this. But actually, when you did look it through, an Irish Language Act would have reached the statute books and Stormont. So at that point, Sinn Féin would have been able to say, look, we got the Irish Language Act that we were hoping for.
So the DUP had agreed and everything but name, well, some type of Irish Language Act or
well,
not?
Well, certainly that document, and the DUP denies it was a deal because they didn't ultimately sign off on it, that included a type of Irish Language Act, a relatively light touch in comparison to some of the versions that we've heard might be possible, but it didn't come to fruition, presumably because the negotiators didn't get the entire Assembly and wider party on side. It went to various meetings and it was decided not to try to sell it to the wider community.
Peter's in Belfast. Morning, Peter.
Well, Stephen, I just thought this morning, listen to you, I thought you had a part-time job working for five parties, beating down the DUP. Now, that's my point of view.
You've got a full-time job dealing with you.
No, but it's all right. And my second point is, when it comes to politics, especially during the British government, both sides, it's not the first time the DUP have had something pulled under their eyes. They signed a Good Friday Agreement, not realising about the unrolling ladders. So these dirty tricks do happen when it comes to British government.
Sorry, Mark, on the run ladders he was talking about, OTR letters.
But they didn't actually say they opposed the Good Friday Agreement, the DUP. They only came in later in the St Andrews Agreement.
Yes, but there's still nobody knew about it. Like me, one agreed to sign it. We didn't realise that these things were happening. So we were swept on. It was an odd eye.
What's your bigger point?
My biggest point is, Stephen, when it comes to the British government, let's be honest, they'll throw us on the bus no matter who it is. At the end of the day, we're just nobodies, as far as they're concerned.
Well, that's why you've got to have, if you think that that's the view, then that's why you've got to have political parties here who do care about you, fighting for you and being effective for you.
Well, if you're standing for the MP for Great Britain or... You're not going to be fighting in a corner if you're not there, are you?
Who are you voting for this time?
I'll probably just go for Aidan Edgell. You know what I mean?
Why?
Because I'll go for him, Stephen. I just think, you know, at the end of the day, I think if it rains tomorrow, it's the DUP's fault. If it snows tomorrow, everything's just blamed on him. And at the end of the day, let's be honest, many people are dying because they can't get hospital appointments, and what's the reason? We can't get an act. So at the end of the day, the Irish Language Act is waiting for it, causing lives as well.
And would an Irish Language Act upset you so much that you think the DUP should stop it happening?
Well, I think, no, it wouldn't annoy me. You know what I mean? I can only say a couple of words of it, so I don't know what it is, you know what I mean?
Peter, thank you. George in Guildford. Morning, George.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, the first thing I can't understand is why the DUP was on for Brexit, knowing that Northern Ireland was going to be in this position, and farmers especially. You knew your man, John Weir, the farmer from Wernstown, he took for them, and now he says he made a mistake. But the other thing what I wanted to say was, Arlene Foster made an awful pig-headed thing when she wouldn't stand down that time about RHI. She wouldn't stand down. Robertson stood down when he was in trouble. And if she would have stood down, she was putting the ball in Sinn Féin's court, and they would have been clutching at straws to get all the excuses, because they wanted out, and she gave them an easy way out. And I can't see them two.
Obviously, Sinn Féin would deny that.
And with you, I can't see them two women. You're always saying about getting back to Stormont. There's not a hope of them two women ever running Stormont. You may get Geoffrey Donaldson and John O'Dowd or somebody that's civil.
Well,
not a hope of them two women. I know women.
Well, those two women, as you refer to them, have names. You're talking about Michelle O'Neill and Arlene Foster.
Yes. You boys burn to sea. You have a brain and you're smart men. There's not a hope of them two ever whipping together. They'll have to get somebody else.
Mark?
I was just going to say, because that was the first mention we've had of the RHI, that all parties have certain things which they play up and play down in their manifestos. For instance, I don't think you can find the word abortion in Sinn Féin's manifesto or the SDLP manifesto. One set of initials that you do not find in these DUP documents is RHI. Maybe, surprise, surprise. There are a couple of mentions that you might think, for instance, possibly a kind of giving a nod to it. For instance, in Let's Make the Assembly Better in their Northern Ireland plan, the DUP talking about reviewing the number of special advisers and how they're appointed and regulated. That's obviously with the RHI in mind. And then there's something in relation to public sector delivery structures. There continues to be criticism of how large public sector projects are managed and delivered in Northern Ireland. We will initiate a review of local procurement and delivery processes and invite world-class international experts to undertake the review and make recommendations for strategic improvement. Certainly the RHI project would fall into one where there'd be an awful lot of criticism. Now, I did put this to Arlene Foster. Why are you talking about an Icelandic electricity interconnector and not the RHI? Of course, she says, look, it's out for an inquiry. We can't really say much until the inquiry reports. That's a sort of a portmanteau response.
And, John, I know it's early in the morning. I'm not sure if you'll have this number or not, but given all the cock-ups over RHI, do we know how much it ended up costing us more than it should have done?
There's still a bit of ambiguity about that, and actually, you know, the thing has been fixed to such an extent that the suggestion that, you know, there's money we would have got the public purse we won't now actually get because they've kind of pushed right down on the how generous the subsidy will be. I don't think you can just look at it though in that narrow sense. You've got to think about the whole opportunity cost for things which could have been done at Stormont that weren't done because of the collapse, the reputational damage, to Northern Ireland in the outside world, the reputational damage to the civil service. And I suppose just to pick up some of the things that the callers have been saying there, even if we do get Stormont restored, that is not going to mean that overnight we're going to solve the health problem. Clearly there needs to be structural change within the Northern Ireland Health Service where you have, you know, the focus of specialisms in small and larger, more efficient hospitals. That will take time to do, and we know that the Permanent Secretary in Health, the senior official, says, listen, to clear the waiting list, we're going to need to find £1 billion from somewhere. We've been through the waiting list thing before, and really what had to happen was a whole bunch of money had to be found. That was then spent in the independent sector, the private sector, the consultants working weekends and evenings and just working through those waiting lists. So even if Stormont does come back, the block grant is what the block grant is. And unless there is a big emergency infusion of funds somewhere, the problem does not get solved very quickly.
And the DP, John, would point, and they do point in their manifesto, to the additional money that they've brought into Northern Ireland through their confidence and supply deal. And they talk about $1.5 billion.
Yeah. Now, most of that money, yes, has been spent. The only outstanding bit is the money for broadband, because that's quite a complicated project and it's currently at the procurement stage where they're finding the company who will actually deliver it.
And $1.5 billion, was it all new money?
I think $1 billion was new. Yeah. $500 million, as I understand it from the time that this was negotiated, was kind of extra flexibility to use money that I think had been promised under, was it the Fresh Start Agreement,
but was
still tied up in the system. Yeah, so they kind of freed that up.
Yeah, that Fresh Start money, the bar they had to kind of clear on which to be able to spend that was actually quite high. So that money was basically locked in the system, but not really available for spending. So they were able to kind of unlock that money and spend it on different things.
Our caller mentioned farmers earlier on. The implications of Brexit to farmers, John.
Yeah.
Are they assured of the payments that they would be getting if we stay in the EU?
No.
Subsidies.
The subsidy system has to be redesigned. So that there is some guarantees for a few years. But Michael Gove, when he's in agriculture, his big idea is that you basically get paid not so much for food production but for public goods. So, improving land, improving the environment, that's where you would kind of get the money. Now, the DUP policy on this is quite ambitious. They say that agriculture should be such a strategic priority at the whole UK level that funding shouldn't be just taken out of the Barnett formula. So just to take a couple of steps back, to explain that at the moment, every year farmers get subsidy from Europe. How much you get really depends on the exchange rate. You know, if the pound is if you get more euros, basically, then, you know, great. So there's an exchange rate risk in there at the moment, that, you know, what the euro pound exchange rate is depends on how much you get. When we move to a UK system, there's going to be new risks in there. It's basically when spending priorities are made at Westminster level and then devolved to a Stormont level, that is when farmers will kind of work out how much money they're going to get. What the DUP are proposing is saying, listen, we should just take agriculture out of the normal kind of spending formula, treat it completely separately, and that Northern Ireland should effectively continue to get proportionally much higher.
And that's because the normal spending formula is just based on a sort of population breakdown.
Yeah.
But as a sector of the economy, agriculture is much more important to Northern Ireland than it would be in the rest of the UK.
Yeah.
The Tories have basically guaranteed that there will be farm payment support for the next 5 years. That, I think, is what Michael Gove said. But the concern I would have thought would have been that if you look at what has fueled some of the whole thing down through the years about Brexit, is that quite often English urban dwellers have seen the common agricultural policy as essentially a French construct, propping up farmers, wine lakes, butter mountains and so on. So if they get Brexit, will they not be looking for cheap food and lowering agriculture?
Let me bring in Noel and Sinn Féin. Morning, Noel.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Noel.
I was just wondering, from somebody from a unionist background, why the DUP wouldn't take every opportunity to come onto the Nolan Show and any other show that's about to try and put their manifesto across. But my main point...
Well, Sammy Wilson answered your question, didn't he? He said that they've devised a strategy to harm me as much as possible, and that's because they didn't like my RHI coverage.
Well, certainly, as I said, I just can't see how that achieves anything for anybody in the DUP line whatsoever.
Meanwhile, the press office say there's no boycott.
But my main quick question is, when Jim Wells made his decision to break parity from UK health pay rises, what effect did the massive overspend from RHI have on Jim Wells' decision, and much pressure was put on RHI misspent money?
I think it predated certainly that coming to the public knowledge. I think it was probably more to do, just off the top of my head, with the sort of austerity approach which was being taken at that point by the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition, which in turn was a response to a financial crisis and the pressure on banks and so on.
Mark, let me ask you about welfare reform and you, John, because in terms of welfare and welfare benefits, we've been told about this so-called cliff edge coming up in a few months' time, where the mitigation, it's in March, isn't it, where the mitigation that there currently is essentially runs out. Did the DUP play any part in those benefit, those people who are availing of benefits currently? Did the DUP allow the vote to go to Westminster? Did they, where the benefit cuts were brought in?
Well, what we had is we had a sort of
welfare reform.
Under welfare, Stormont always operated on the basis of parity. Nothing to do with nurses' pay at the moment, but it's basically us staying in line with the benefits that will be paid to claimants across the water, and so. Although technically we put through the legislation, when we had that crisis over welfare, it was because if we had broken from parity and paid more generous benefits or not come in with the new system that the coalition government was pushing at that point, Stormont would have had to have borne the difference. So there was an argument within the executive between Sinn Féin that was holding out saying we don't want to put this in place, and the DUP and some other parties who were saying, look, we can't break from parity, it's not a financial possibility. And you'll remember that we had a whole crisis.
That's right.
Like Stormont was going to fall at that stage. How they got out of that is that they found the resources within the Stormont budget to put together this mitigation package, which was drawn up by the welfare expert Eileen Everson and a panel of people. And I think it's fair to say that the DUP would have had a role in allowing that to go forward to resolve that crisis that was threatening Stormont at this stage. And they say in their manifesto that Sinn Féin's refusal to form an executive puts these vital protections for the vulnerable at risk, creating a cliff edge for those most in need of security. And so they basically support a new mitigations package and regulations in Northern Ireland based on the updated report. And the key date, I think, is around March, when those mitigations may run out.
So on welfare reform, ultimately, there was a very long and exhausting battle between Sinn Féin and the DUP in this, which eventually ended in that kind of compromise where, you know, there was kind of partial mitigation for how people were going to be hit. You know, I'm sure, you know, we spent an awful lot of time talking about that over the years, but in the end, they
reached the deal. I well remember coming into the Stormont canteen after that crisis was resolved, and because there was a certain amount of backing down by various parties, I wondered and said, oh, what about this? And then, oh, this is old news. This is all sorted. So it may well be that at some point, people will say, when there's an Irish Language Act, oh, did you not know about that ages ago? That was sorted ages
Here's
ago.
Here's David Neese, Belfast. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, David.
Congratulate you for bringing me and the country the most eloquent set of answers to political questions I've ever heard on any media. The silence was deafening. As far as I can see, Boris and the DUP are well matched, because Boris has been already represented as a melting ice sculpture because of his absence, and I would suggest maybe the DUP should be represented as a damp bonfire or a wet, very wet union flag this morning. I hope that the electorate note the disrespect with which they have been treated by the DUP this morning and vote accordingly.
Well, I would say, David, in the DUP's defence, that they are participating in interviews across the media spectrum. Many, many newspaper journalists, many journalists and our colleagues in UTV, and indeed many BBC programmes. And I would point you to those BBC programmes if you want to find out any answers from the DUP. Go online, get their manifesto.
Yes, indeed, and I have already, although I haven't read it all. But, I quite take your point. But still, you are the greatest show in the country, the biggest show in the country, and there should be at least have somebody on there answering your questions, because the questions that you've asked are the questions that should be on everybody's lips. And actually, the discussion that you've had this morning has also been very helpful and very clear.
Well, David, thank you very much indeed. John Campbell, thank you, sir. Mark Devenport, thank you very much indeed. Every other political party has set themselves up for scrutiny on the Nolan Show for their manifestos. Sinn Féin have promised that they will be here tomorrow, and Conor Murphy will be taking your calls, and he will be having the Sinn Féin manifesto scrutinised.